So why don't we get started? I'm Mark Kessler, and I'm here to convene this session, which I want to remind you is called How Sick Can We Afford to Be? Reflections on the Healthcare Reform Debates of 2010 from a Group Relations Perspective. And I introduced the title first before introducing Charlotte, because the question may come up, why does Charlotte talk about health care? You know, after all, what gives her the right to do this? Well, what gives her the right to do this, since that question has arisen before in some context, is that for at least 40 years, Charlotte has been involved in the healthcare system in a number of roles, in thinking about developing, working with, providing services in a number of settings in healthcare. So she's had a long history of thinking about health and healthcare services in the United States. She's been a manager of services, trained in development directors or consultants. She's been on the faculty of schools of nursing, both in California and Oregon. She's worked in every kind of healthcare organization that you can imagine existing in the United States, both the purely socialized system of Veterans Administration, private for-profit hospitals, HMOs, university medical centers, public health service clinics. So her experience is very, you know, it's extensive, very deep. She's facilitated the origins of coalitions of nursing practitioners, nursing homes, long-term care clinics, geriatric services, geriatric nursing services, and for many years provided leadership education for nurses. So clearly, she's had an extensive background in understanding and thinking about the healthcare system. Her involvement in ACRI and group relations work is legendary. And also focused, in my mind it's legendary. In my mind it's legendary. And, you know, I mean, and one of the most important contributions I think she has made to group relations has always been in the focus on helping other people to learn, helping us to learn how to do this work. She wrote the primer for ACRI. She wrote the second primer for ACRI. She, when she was the director of the national conference, she introduced the learning track system into the conferences to provide a methodology and an opportunity for all of us to develop our skills and our knowledge about group relations. And she continues to provide that kind of thinking. So I just wanted to give a little bit of that flavor of who this person is who's coming to talk to us about health care. and in this talk, what Charlotte hopes to engage us all in a dialogue about is the application of group relations thinking to the healthcare debate that's going on currently in the United States, and helping us to think about this from a group relations perspective. So, without further ado.
If I need an agent, I will know. So the first thing I'd like to ask you to do is to look around the room carefully. And consider the following question. Of those of us who are here right now, whose flesh do you think is most valuable?
Mirror, mirror on the wall.
I'm sort of assuming that many of you would think it was yours, first of all. But then you might consider that other people's flesh that's here might be worth preserving. But this question really underpins my fundamental interest in the healthcare systems, or lack of same, that we have in this country. So I'd sort of like to have you keep that in mind as we move along. Was it hard for you to choose when you thought about that? No.
Not really.
Very
cynical.
Yes, yes. It was yours?
No.
Oh, it was someone else's.
Oh, I might have been in the group. It was kind of boring.
Okay.
You asked the question too broadly. It wasn't clear for what purpose.
Well, to stay alive,
well,
just fundamentally. Yes, exactly. Well, in reality, 16% of the people in this room wouldn't really have access to any means to keep themselves alive. So we'd have to figure out how many of you or what portion of a whole human we'd have to let expire in this room if we were to maintain the same system that we have now. Of course, that decision isn't being made consciously or purposefully. Nobody is planning for who can expire because the rest of us are too inert to be concerned about it. I shouldn't say to be concerned about it, but to act on the knowledge of it. So essentially, this paper is about exploring the unconscious level phenomena that I think must underpin what we're doing, because I don't think it can be explained simply by economics or philosophy, or I don't think that, and we will look at some of those explanations, which I think are helpful, some of them more than others, but here's what I'm going to try to do with your help today, which is to consider the possibility that there could be basic assumption life active in something as big as the 307 million people who live in this country. Right? Because while there are people avidly pursuing healthcare reform, as we know, we are still stuck in a system that's basically had us in its grip since the 70s at some point, the 1970s. And the evolution hasn't been toward more humanity. It's been toward more complexity, for sure. So that's what I really want to take a look at, and I hope you'll help me, because I can't say that I feel that I've got the right formulation around basic assumption life, but I have some guesses, and it's complicated. So I want you to go there with me. But I am going to explore a few other ideas. First of all, I'm going to outline sort of how the healthcare system is in outline these days. Then I'm going to talk about some of the more problematic aspects of it. Then I'm going to apply some economic theory to it and some almost financial theory, although I have to tell you those two terrains are not my normal stomping grounds. So please, those of you who know more about economics than I do, bring it, because I think it's incredibly important. And then we'll look at the basic assumption possibilities underlying why the system is the way it is and continues to be. Although Mark gave me good news today, it was in Michigan, where the federal district court maintained it was challenged, the idea that people had to purchase health insurance for their own lives, and the district court upheld it because the idea was that otherwise the healthcare system would be even more taxed.
Well, using the Interstate Commerce Clause, that this does have an impact on across the country.
On everybody else, which is exactly my question, is why aren't we moving in that direction faster? You know, seeing that in some fundamental way all of our flesh is connected. Right? So the question is why aren't we attending to that? Or obviously we're attending. Why is it such a struggle? So, you with me? Is this the thing you came to listen to? It's going to be a little different than the abstract because, of course, in the making of it, I took different paths, but it's more or less in that territory. So, the way I got into this was that I read a guest column by a guy named Lawrence Wallach in the local paper, The Oregonian, several months ago, and he quoted Thomas Pynchon, the novelist who wrote Gravity's Rainbow, The Crying of Lot 49, a bunch of other things you've probably read. And the quote from that he used is, if they can get you asking the wrong questions, they don't have to worry about the answers. And he goes on to explicate it, which from my point of view is exactly what's been happening in the health reform debate, is the wrong questions have been being addressed. And here's what he goes on to say. Those who are looking to reform healthcare have taken on as their central question the issue of controlling costs. And what he says is that we focus on how we can bend the cost curve. But for the opponents of reform, there could be no better question to occupy the do-gooders with. Right? How can we manage this cost? And from his point of view, the opponents of reform are occupied with entirely different questions, namely, are we willing to give up our freedom? So the terms are not at all in the same arena. Control cost versus give up freedom, choose your doctor, go to anybody you want to, choose the health plan you want, you know, all of that stuff. John Boehner, the House Minority Leader, said recently, this was before the health care reform bill got passed in some form at least, John Boehner said, this bill is the greatest threat to freedom that I have seen in the 19 years I have been here in Washington. It's going to lead to a government takeover of our health care system with tens of thousands of new bureaucrats right down the street making these decisions. Choose your doctor, buy your own insurance for you. So from his point of view, therein is the problem. The reformers are arguing about cost and efficiency, and the opponents are arguing about freedom and competence of the systems you want to use. When that's the argument, of course freedom wins. Yes, I mean, we're Americans, right? So, you know, we want freedom at sort of any cost, except we're not so worried about the people who can't pay the cost. Let's see. So Wallach just goes on to talk about how fear and resentment is much easier to sell than a sense of responsibility for everyone's flesh, certainly in this country. And then he quoted Harry Truman, which I had to quote here, because Truman was an early reformer in the healthcare debate, right? Truman was one of the earliest presidents to advocate for healthcare reform. It didn't work in his administration. But he said, the American people cannot read the writing on the wall until their backs are up against it. And I maintain that our backs are up against it right now, but I don't know that we're reading the handwriting very well, or at least not everyone is.
You can't turn around.
We have to look. We have to look at our back, you know, what the shadow behind this, before we could even go somewhere with it. So just a few statistics. I thought about PowerPointing these, but I want you to just let them flow rather than fixate on each one. They're very interesting. As I said, the population of our country is about 307 million. Many of us, somewhere between 70 and 80% of us, have some form of health care insurance. But let me point out the following. Many of us are covered by already by government-sponsored programs already. So just listen to this list. If you're in the military, if you're a veteran with privileges of being treated, you're covered by the government. Medicare, Medicaid, the Native American Health Service. If you're in end-stage renal failure, you are covered. And all legislators are covered. Everywhere. So, and then the amount of health care insurance that the federal government actually underwrites is 60%. So it's a myth that the government isn't already funding the majority of health care, right? Not just in these systems, but through pass-throughs for various coverage with other organizations. The number of us estimated to be underinsured, however, is about 60 million, or at least 20% of those of us who are covered by health insurance. And the definition of underinsured means that we could face financial disaster, that the health care we need, depending upon the analysis of chronic illnesses and acute illnesses, is that we could be forced to pay at least 10% or more of our resources in order to get the care we needed to stay alive. And that was the definition of underinsurance that this author used. I told you already that 14 to 16% of us are vulnerable without any insurance. And that's about 47 or 48 million, depending upon what author you read. This is the most fascinating statistic of all, and this crosses several different researchers that I read. Approximately 22,000 people in the United States die every year because they weren't able to access health care that would have sustained their lives.
Could you repeat that?
22,000 people in this country are dying each year, and this is estimated by 3 or 4 different researchers, because they can't access the care that would sustain their lives. That's not a lot compared to 307 million. But the question is, why? Why are we willing to do that?
How many people die every year in the midst of accessing health care?
Well, that's a figure I couldn't get my hands on, Neil. But yes, exactly. The number of people who go bankrupt specifically because of their medical bills in this country is estimated at 700,000 a year. And there are many more. There's some, I've forgotten what even, I think it's like 2 million people who go bankrupt every year in the United States. Healthcare bills are a major factor. Not the factor, but with 700,000, people's lives are ruined, literally.
And that takes money elsewhere out of the economy as well.
Absolutely.
They're bankrupt, they're not paying.
Right.
They don't have to pay all the things they owe.
In 1950, healthcare consumed 4% of the national economy. Now it's 17%. Unsustainable, and at least 3% more of even the next developed country, which stands in at like 14%. And then they go way, 14%, I can't remember which other country it is, but then everybody else is below 10% of their national GNP goes to healthcare. So we're way up there. In 2009, the three largest health insurers made a combined profit of $12.2 billion, 56% higher than they had made in 2008. Two of them announced that they had to raise their rates because of the economic downturn.
Insurance companies?
Yeah, three major insurers. Those are WellPoint, United Health Group, and Aetna, in case any of them underwrite your insurance.
And their stock went up.
Yeah, of course their stock went up.
When the bill was passed.
Yeah. Interesting, isn't it? Yeah. We don't know exactly why, but...
Oh, yes, we do.
Do we?
Yeah, we do.
Of course we know why.
Their stock went up because...
Because you're going to be forced to buy their insurance.
Oh, I see. Well, they don't. They didn't comprehend the full deal on the other end, though. That would be nice if they don't understand the whole Reform Act.
Well, they do. That's why they're fighting the other side of it.
Okay.
Yes, you should buy it from us, but we should decide when.
Then we should be able to skim
control it.
Right, exactly. We'll look into a few more of their practices. But what I'd like to say about this is that I think it's easy to fixate on one of the major systems that's in trouble, right? And one of them is insurance. One of the books, as you'll see in the bibliography that's rolling around here somewhere, is by a guy named John Gaiman, who's written several books. And one of his books talks about the death of the health insurance business industry. And he outlines several factors that he believes are going to lead to its demise. But anyway, it's really fascinating. My main point is there is no one actor in this story to blame. There's several factors to blame, and my point of view is, why haven't we collectively taken responsibility to make this reform happen? We're in the interstices between democracy and capitalism, and I'll talk a lot more about that. So, I already said I'd like you to join me in an exploration of what may seem to be complicated at the beginning, but it's something I've wanted to do for a long time. That is to try to apply the hypotheses about basic assumption functioning to very large groups' behavior. I don't know if it'll prove helpful, but I've looked for explanations to help me understand this very distressing social issue of our day. And I have come to the conclusion that there must be basic assumption functioning under this, or we wouldn't be doing it, because there's so many reasons that we should move to a single-party payer, government-regulated healthcare process. So to carry out the exploration, I'm going to talk about basic assumption functioning briefly, although maybe I won't waste time on it. What I was going to do is briefly review the five basic assumptions, the three that Bion hypothesized, and then merger and meanness, oneness and meanness. But if all of you know all about those, I'm not going to do that. Is there anybody who needs for me to do a reminder on those? Okay, cool. I'm going to skip that. Although I do want to say to you about meanness that when it first was hypothesized in 1995 as an opposite to the basic assumption around oneness, the idea of merging, that there's no individuation, a group becomes a clump of humans without individuals in it. And when Gould and Bain and who is the other guy, Lawrence, hypothesized the me-ness, in other words, the absence of a group, that all there is there are individuals and that there's no group, I thought, tish, you know, what are they talking about? I have to tell you, it's become more real for me over time. So I have to claim being sort of anti-me. Well, I'm still anti-me-ness.
But you believe in it.
But I think it's there, yes. So, and as you know, in terms of how we think about this theoretically, the basic assumption life of any group isn't ever exhausted, nor is it essential for the group to get rid of its basic assumptions often. The only real question is whether it is consonant with the task or purpose of the group or whether it works against it. And so when we get to this question about is meanness at work in keeping the situation as it is in healthcare in our country, what purpose is it serving, right? So I think it's really interesting. So let me give you a few, the five areas of the healthcare system that's written about by most of the authors that I read in preparation for this are insurance, drugs, hospitals, organized medicine, and business in general. So let me just give you a few facts about each of these entities. At the current rate of increase, the cost of the average annual healthcare insurance premium for families will consume all of the average household income by 2025. If it stays on the trajectory of cost it is now. Most insurance has been profit-based over the last 40 years. Didn't start that way, and I'll talk a little bit about history. Most of the insurance systems, the private ones, avoid the coverage of sick people. You know, they cream, they go for populations that are healthy and try to avoid populations that have more risk. And then they actually do their budget analysis based on the MLR. Anybody know what MLR is? That's called the medical loss ratio, which means the amount you actually had to pay to cure somebody. That's considered a negative in the budgets of most of these for-profit companies. They talk about their MLR, or how much of their income or revenue they actually had to spend on keeping somebody's health up good, keeping them alive or what have you. I find that fascinating to look at.
As if that's not their task.
Well, exactly. Well, the question is it? Right? Right. Yeah, so I find it fascinating that these budget sheets have MLR on it, meaning the cost you actually had to pay to deliver health care. Right. So let's see what else. We talked about cost. There's increasing cost for less coverage. Many of us are quite insecure about whether our coverage will be there next year or whether it will be at the level at which we wish it would stay, right? So there's a lot more anxiety. And this one gives me great pain, but I've read endless amounts of material on the lobbying efforts in Washington that are mounted by the insurance companies, the private for-profit insurance companies, and the revolving door of people who serve in Congress and who later go to work for some of these major insurance companies. It's really gut-wrenching to see the data about this. Drugs. They've grown more rapidly in cost than any other facet of healthcare. Drug companies are the largest for-profit firms in healthcare. They even outpace the insurance companies. They only spend 6% more, they do spend 6% more on their marketing than they do on their research. Sort of interesting, isn't it? They too have very powerful lobbies. Consumers have very little bargaining power with drug companies. At least in the insurance arena, if you're in a big enough coalition of customers of those insurance companies and you find some way of gathering together to enforce what you want, you can possibly make a difference. But with drug companies, it's almost impossible to have an impact on their prices. The only people that have an impact on their prices are major purchasers, like Kaiser Permanente and National Delivery System, or some of the other big delivery systems. Those are, it's only through the agencies of us being members of somebody's system that we can have any, that drug costs can be held down, and we have very little say in it. And the other thing which I found distressing is that somebody had done some research about the education that physicians receive from drug company reps. The average physician meets at least one drug company rep once a week, and the level of misinformation that the MDs themselves recognized as happening during this time over a year is 26% of the time they realized they were being told something that wasn't accurate. Right, so there's a fair amount of miseducation going on in the marketing process around medications. For-profit hospitals, depending
can I,
on...
Can I
yeah,
two things
please.
About the drugs?
Yeah, please.
The first thing is that when the Medicare drug benefit went in under Bush, the requirement was that the federal government could not negotiate drug prices, that they had to pay what the drug companies wanted.
Uh-huh,
right?
Uh-huh.
And secondly, drug company profits jumped, I forget what percentage, when they were allowed, or when they broke the agreement and started doing direct-to-consumer advertising. So now you pick up Life magazine, which Newsweek,
right.
You know, Time. Every publication has direct-to-consumer advertising.
Right, exactly.
Well, turn on television.
Or television.
Right, ask your doctor.
Ask your doctor. And
right.
The profits have soared.
Mm-hmm.
Or tell your doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Tell your doctor.
Tell your doctor,
yeah,
more likely.
Really
go
bad.
Tell
yeah.
your doctor, mm-hmm. right. And then you always see those disclaimers, you know, may lead to instant death.
Right.
Right.
Uh-huh. Really, they do, yeah.
And Charlotte, I don't know if you're going to address this, but of course at the interface between the insurance companies and the drug companies is this peculiarity that if you have insurance, what you pay for medication is so much less than if you don't have insurance.
Yes, exactly.
So basically the haves are subsidized by the have-nots.
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely true. It's very upsetting. That's one of the most upsetting things about this is the inequality of the ability to pay and what happens there. Yeah. Hospitals, for-profit hospitals, depending on the region you're in, they cost 3 to 11% more, and their outcomes are worse. There's a huge amount of fraud involved
between
with them.
Between what and what?
Between not-for-profit and for-profit, yeah. 6 to 7% higher death rates for the same kinds of admissions as not-for-profit hospitals. They tend to deal in dangerously short lengths of stay, according to Gaiman, the physician that wrote this book about the insurance company. Their administrative costs are incredibly high, as are their ancillary services costs. So for-profit hospitals, one of the points that one of the people I read made is that not-for-profits are acting a great deal like for-profits these days, only they don't pay their money to shareholders. They plow it back into the development of their systems. And people like me, I have to say, out of all the things that Mark read about me and my work in healthcare, either as an employee or a consultant, are true. I was a middle-class wage earner in a lot of healthcare systems. So to the degree that healthcare has been a major employment system for middle-class professionals, I certainly have benefited from that, right? I mean, of course, I always said to myself I was delivering value for my salary. But honestly, you know, I was a part of this massive number of middle-class people, non-clinicians largely, administrators, managers, quality assurance people, et cetera, who made their living in these big systems, right? This is very interesting to notice that for me. Organized medicine, let's see here, much profit, many managed care systems are profit driven, and you know the original idea was that they would keep costs down by managing cases, by managing referrals to specialties more thoughtfully, et cetera, but instead a lot of managed care systems are working to produce profit for their shareholders. Competition between organized healthcare systems is only true in major regions of population density. But out in the countryside, in rural America, there's very little competition among systems. So even capitalism doesn't function in favor of the consumer out there. It's really interesting. We don't have enough competition out in the hinterlands. Patients are often undertreated, especially in mental health, rehab, and home care. The risks of dying that this author estimated among lower-income people who were members of HMO care is 21% more than in fee-for-service situations. It's pretty bad. And then just briefly, the business side. So remember, those were the first four. And then the business side is that, let's see what, I'll tell you all of this. There's a whole bunch of it. You know about the inequality of incomes and how it's widening, job instability, environmental destruction, human rights are being violated abroad, etc. This person, this is Robert Reich, for those of you who've read the Work of Nations, and the book of his that I read was called Supercapitalism, and I'll be talking a lot about that. From his point of view, there's no means of balancing anymore our desires as consumers and investors as our responsibilities as citizens. So I'll talk about that a bit more when I get into the point. Yeah. Okay. Yeah,
I'm stuck back at the statistic, contrast between percentage of low-income people dying in HMO
versus fee-for-service. The risks of dying. The risks of dying among lower-income people in HMOs is 21% more than in fee-for-service. In other words, when you're paying for your care, you have more likelihood of not dying. Do you know? But if you're in somebody's system, you fall through the cracks more easily. Hmm. Yeah, it's counterintuitive, I agree.
And is that distinction, is the profit, non-profit factored in there somewhere, or is that just entirely independent?
That I don't know. I think this was under the organized medicine section of the book that I read, and I think it didn't mediate for that.
Poor get poor services.
What?
The poor get poor services.
Yeah, more or less. Let me say a word about obesity, because this is one of the things that interests me a lot, is what is this current debate? You know, there are programs in every state to avoid childhood obesity. Everybody's trying to activate that. Everybody believes it's an important social responsibility to defat our country. Yeah, well, not everybody. Business, here's the deal about soft drinks. In 1970, we drank 24.3 gallons a person. 27 years later, in 1997, we drank 53 gallons a person in a year.
Soft drinks?
Uh-huh, soft drinks.
You mean just sugared or sugared over all?
Sugared, real ones, not diet.
Light beer?
What?
Does that include light beer?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. We have 20. What's that?
What were the dates on it?
In 1970, we drank 24.3 gallons a person. In 1997, 53 gallons a year per person. This is not because Americans just decided to do more. It's like the marketing, you know, marketing to our children, marketing to adults, etc. The average fat content of an adult diet between 1970 and the late 1990s is 25% more. And the calories ingested per person in that same period of time went from 3,300 a day per person to 3,800 a day per person.
Well,
in 1998, 11,000 new products entered the market, that more than two-thirds of which were condiments, candy, snacks, baked goods, soft drinks, cheeses, and ice cream novelties. Business is not really interested in our health, I think, is the main point here. I wanted to say a word about, so those are the five factors that are thought about by most people who are tracking why healthcare is out of kilter here, insurance, drugs, et cetera. Yeah.
But it seems to me that there's another side to that obesity issue that you raised, and that is, you know, one, there are people who are profiting from the causes of obesity.
Right.
But
right.
Aren't there also cost benefits to insurance companies if we reduce obesity?
Well, yes, but clearly they're not making much of a difference. And it depends on what the insurance company is doing, you know, what they're insuring against. The couple of the authors I read talked about whether healthcare sees as its mission the prevention of illness or whether it makes more money from acute illnesses. And the hypothesis is it's making a lot more money from acute illnesses. So keeping us unhealthy, with our agreement, is probably more profitable than sponsoring healthcare that's boring, namely preventive services. So there's not much money in prevention. One of the people that I studied with years ago in LA said that he thought the purpose of all healthcare should be to make itself unnecessary. You know, as a basic social hypothesis.
But I mean, just to stay with that for a moment,
yeah.
You know, the prevention, I mean, I don't know about other people in the room, but I certainly know that the insurance I carry over the last couple of decades has increasingly thrown in preventive stuff without regard to increases in premium, I mean, at least none that I can see.
Right.
So doesn't that...
Well, let me tell you about the efficacy of those. This I know about personally because I spent the last 2.5 years as the human resources director for a big... natural foods company in Portland. They had 10 stores in the metro area, and they are as green can be as far as thoughtful environmental practices, et cetera. So I was always on the boundary negotiating their health benefits. I read the research about these prevention strategies. Almost none of them work. They're mostly online services, or you will get a call if you're diagnosed with hypertension or high cholesterol. You'll get a call from a nurse in the insurance company saying, have you had it checked recently or what have you. The modalities they know that work for prevention are social affiliations. Do you know? So programs like Weight Watchers or gyms where people work out together, or they walk around malls together, or... you know, they check their blood together if they're diabetics, or they share recipes. Social interventions work for, and also, as we know, the authority of a physician or another healthcare professional who says you should do this. That's another intervention that tends to work. But most of the methods that the insurance companies are applying for wellness preservation or prevention are not working, and they know it.
Yeah, actually, if you are speaking, I realize that I was thinking of early detection rather
yes.
than prevention.
That's different. That's different. But then what do they do after that? So, I became much more cynical doing that job.
They drop you.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. That's why portability is going to be very important in the future. Right. So let's see, what else? The administrative costs, I'm going to go back to a more general view now. The administrative costs for 31% of U.S. spending on health care is unnecessary. If we were to save the amount now spent on administrative processes in our health care system, we could pay for all of the uninsured people without raising any costs. Think about it. Think about how many bills you get after an episode of care. Think about how many telephone calls you need to make to decipher what they say. Think about how many transactions there are for bills for $5. You get a bill for a copay that you didn't make on time, or $20. Literally, we could cover everyone who's not currently covered, 47, 48 million people, with the amount of money we would save if we went to a single-payer system.
And why is it there wouldn't be all those same bills for...
Because every company has their own administrative system that has to interact with the patient and the delivery system. All insurance companies have all these people who interact with all the delivery systems, and they interact with all the patients or clients.
At the level of the healthcare organization,
yeah.
The level of the... of each of us, and we all have all of that. We're
right.
only a single insurance company, as we would if it was single payer. So why would
overhead costs, for example, the overhead costs, think about Medicare and Medicare premium, the managed Medicare system. The difference with the managed Medicare system, of course, it was a sop to the insurance companies. The difference in the overhead costs between those two systems, where you bring in the private sector, it increases almost 20% the cost of the overhead, simply paperwork. Medicare overhead costs are about 4% of the total costs.
right?
Way low compared to normal.
For-profit health insurance runs 20-30% for doing the same job.
Sure.
Does that make sense, Gordon? It's so elaborate and so complex.
I don't see how it would be any different if, you know, there's a certain amount that Medicare doesn't pay.
Uh-huh.
So that the providers are still going to be coming after me for that. Mm-hmm. If I, you know, and there's still going to be bills for tiny amounts. Mm-hmm. Because you're calling all of that part of what would be saved. And I guess I'm...
Mm-hmm. No, if you look at the Canadian system, for example, where there's a single payer,
there's a set price for each service, first of all. It's not debatable. It's regulated.
And there's one piece of paper that has to be filled out. You don't have to, you're not spending, you don't have an array of...
It's just
okay,
that...
Okay, so there's an assumption, not just single source of insurance, but
right.
There's much more that is being implied than that.
That's right. There's a lot of regulation.
Right. But again, if you're talking about the basic assumptions, then it seems to me if you don't spell out that it isn't just a matter of a single payer... But we're talking about a system like they would have in France, or they have.
Absolutely.
And it seems to me that's going to generate a whole lot of additional resistance. I mean.
Oh yes, but that's because we're being fed fear, and all the other developed countries have systems that we should have, and we I've read a lot about us Americans and how we are exceptional. We love to be exceptional. So why would we want to follow anything that France or Germany or India or any other place does? We operate on the principle of exceptionalism, which is mighty close to mean-ass in a collective sense. You with me? I mean, all of the stuff that's being fed to us by the anti-reform people is fascinating. Frank?
In the figures about administrative costs, are actuarial costs in there?
Yes.
Because I've read, I think, in Paul Krugman that if you take the cost of the actuarial component of private health care insurers, that you actually could cover all the uninsured people in the country if you cut out what it costs to employ people to decide who
all
can't
have
health care paid for by their insurance.
There is a huge amount of that, and I'll tell you about my grocery company in a minute, because it was fascinating what I was able to do, because we had a young, healthy population. And every year they came to me and said, we're raising your rates 20%, and I said, no. You want our business? The answer is no. And they kept us. And they kept us because the average age of our staff was 30.
Yeah. I think the point with regard to the actual delivery would probably be more about the same, but the issues of marketing costs that are duplicated across major companies, the issue of the actuarial costs being duplicated across all these companies, as well as the issue of setting up specific plans for specific companies that get designed in specific ways for different tiers of employees, all of that takes a lot of money to make happen. And
absolutely.
So I think in that area, that's where there's a tremendous amount of cost saving. If that were,
totally. And
that just wouldn't happen.
And the sad part about this is that people like me will all lose their jobs. The middle-class people who've made a living from the medical complex, if you will, or the medical industry or the healthcare industry or whatever you want to call it, won't have jobs anymore.
So that's a huge resistance.
Yeah, so this is not just about shareholders who own stock in for-profit insurance companies and hospital systems and stuff like that. There are a lot of us in the middle class who have benefited from the growth of the complex system we now have. So there's plenty of responsibility to be shared, I'd like to say.
Well, I was just going to say, Bernie, it's not the sheer paperwork of submitting the payment. There are people who are coders. You know about the coders.
Mm-hmm.
Who make very, very, very good money going around from hospital to hospital, figuring out how to bill the insurance companies so that the hospital maximizes the amount of money they get. And they pay tremendous salaries. The amount of money that's made just in submitting bills, which employs lots and lots of people.
That's right.
Everybody's been to a hospital and you've found the billing office, which is a huge part of any hospital. Go to Canada. Go to any hospital and I dare you to find their billing office. They usually have one person in that office who submits what needs to be submitted to the National Health Service. And that's where you're going to lose a lot of jobs.
Yeah.
But there are people employed in the National Health Service office
to whom those folks are sending those bills.
The overhead costs are a fraction.
Way, way, way less. In one hospital that I worked, the coder, the woman who was the head of the coding department, actually made more than the average family practitioner that was employed in the primary care clinics. Yeah,
right.
Isn't that fascinating? Yeah.
I think this whole element of choice gets tied in, too, to being an American.
Absolutely.
Individuality.
Absolutely.
Because it's my choice, and you're taking away my choice.
Right,
but there's no evidence that they're taking
Right, there's
away
no evidence that that's actually true, but you're right. It's sold to us that way.
Yes, I think choice is a huge piece.
As if the insurance companies give you free choice.
But you think you can choose your insurance company and by what you make your level of care.
That's right.
And we've already poisoned the word choice.
Right.
So let me share a little bit about the history of this. It really caught on quickly. In 1930, Baylor University in Dallas created an insurance plan for public school teachers. It was really a humane plan. It cost $6 a year to insure their families in 1930. And they guaranteed each teacher in their plan up to 3 weeks of care in a semi-private room if her doctor, and in this case most of them were women, ordered hospitalization. They created a plan after they had examined the unpaid bills they had and realized that many of the delinquent patients were teachers. And that's how this sort of prepaid collective health care plan emerged in this country, was at Baylor. It happened in a couple of other places, somewhere up in Michigan. But the private insurance companies looked at that and they thought that they weren't in healthcare business yet, and they said, what a weird idea. That's going to die out. Do you know, and about 3 years later, they realized as these has expanded across the country that actually there was opportunity for profit. And so, you know, Blue Cross, which was not for profit in the beginning, and Blue Shield, which was not for profit in the beginning, in the early days stayed not for profit, but later on they couldn't stay in that mode. They had to go for profit to compete with the other for profit insurance companies that had grown up over the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So the move from not for profit insurance to for profit was relatively rapid. And, of course, the majority of us are covered by for-profit health insurance companies somewhere along the line. The zillions of mergers that have occurred over the years have made it very hard to actually trace which system you're insured by in some cases. And it changes all the time with the mergers that go on. Just a brief history of the healthcare reform movement in this country. FDR held back on putting Medicare forward because they were afraid it would sabotage the passing of Social Security. It was definitely on his agenda to try to pass a Medicare provision, but he decided to hold it back because he thought it would doom the move towards Social Security. They were right because the American Medical Association defeated a clause in the Social Security legislation that would have authorized a study to be made of healthcare system problems. Truman then supported the national health system but failed. Eisenhower tried. Kennedy tried again in the early 60s, but it failed to pass the Senate by 3 votes. Johnson managed to get Medicare passed in 1965, though the AMA spent $7 million to defeat it. This is a quote. Medicare was the last wave in a tide of liberal reform that had begun at the turn of the century with the progressive movement of upper middle class people. It reached a climax after Social Security and the New Deal programs. Like the New Deal, Medicare was enacted in a time of unrest and struggle. This is very interesting. One during the Great Depression and the Industrial Union drive, and the other during the Civil Rights and anti-Vietnam movements. So you sort of, if you get the picture, that these were just sidelines to what was going on in the country at that time. The Depression and then the Civil Rights and Vietnam controversy were the eras in which these reform acts occurred. I think that's fascinating.
And Charlie, what about Medicaid? When was it?
Medicaid happened later, didn't it? Yeah, I don't remember, though. It may have been in the late 60s, early 70s.
I just
I don't know.
You know, it's funny.
It's a good question. It was later than Medicare, I believe.
Well, I think Medicaid was part of the war on poverty.
Yeah. Yeah, so it would have been in the 70s, probably, late 60s, early 70s. Yeah, bless his heart, to say, in spite of the ways in which his presidency failed, we really owe him a debt for a lot of social programs. I'm not going to bore you with all the details about how insurance has sort of made this thing not work, but skimming is a fascinating. The experience I had with this company where I could just say no to the cost increases, and they wanted so badly to keep our population, so they didn't try to push this was in a company that was a part of Cigna, a national program, but it wasn't called that at our level. It had a regional name, but it was a Cigna subsidiary. And so we avoided almost a 20% increase in cost to our company because they wanted our healthy young people. You know, they didn't go, you know, they wanted to get money. They had to go get money elsewhere. The rest of the history of healthcare reform in this country is, of course, the Clintons tried it in the 90s, and Obama's administration has had modest success with the passage of the current Reform Act, although we're just waiting for legislative attacks on it to pull it back in. So I'd like to talk to you about a couple of people who have theories about why this situation is allowed to continue, and then move into the exploration of basic assumption life and think about the question of is there me-ness underneath our citizens' incapacity to make this different. Or as Mark said to me when I told him about this, he said, "What made you think that Americans ever wanted to take responsibility for each other's health?" Right? So, there you are. This is why I think he's my perfect...
foil.
I'm his perfect... He's my perfect convener. Okay. So, you guys may have heard of a book written by a journalist named Thomas Reed. Tom Reed, he went all around the world. He's written a book that's on there, The Healing of America, A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Healthcare. He has a bad shoulder, and he spent a couple of years traveling around the world to various developed countries, having his shoulder issue diagnosed and proposing their treatments for it, right? I think he went to 7 countries, France, England, Canada, India, Germany, Switzerland, and Taiwan.
Taiwan.
And he got various remedies suggested. He actually got good, attentive care in every system that he went to. But the proposals for treatment of this bad shoulder varied from India, which was the lowest tech, longest duration treatment that he was proposed. There was a lot of relaxation, meditation, massage, diet change, you know, all kinds of like fundamental practice remedies were suggested, that they were going to take it 6 or 8 weeks. The most high-tech solutions were proposed in the U.S., and I think Switzerland. They wanted to go in and like change his shoulder all around to fix it, although there was not much, they couldn't guarantee that the surgery would work. It was a confusing value proposition, but they definitely had the science and technology to do this. And other remedies were physical therapy and things like that. He, in the process of doing this, explored all of the healthcare system's arrangements. And so this book is about why are we crazy? You know, why have we not seen what every other system sees? It's not that there aren't for-profit delivery systems in some of these countries, in particular the Swiss have a fair number of for-profit delivery systems, but they're regulated by the same payment restrictions for basic health care that all the non-for-profit systems are. If you want to buy up medical procedures that have not been proved to be efficacious or are strictly cosmetic, you can buy up in these for-profit systems. You can definitely do that. So you can pay personally for more advanced forms of care. But these for-profit systems can't charge you any more for all the things that are known to be efficacious that are ordinary, either acute or chronic episodes of a need for care. So he went all around, and he points out a couple of things. He's the one who talks about, he says that he believes that one reason we do this and we're not going to follow our sister nations is American exceptionalism that says to us that we're a strong, wealthy, and enormously productive country that is sui generis, the Latin term, you know, self-generating. We don't need anybody else. And we don't need to borrow any ideas from the rest of the world. So thank you very much. But, you know, you might have to wait for a surgery in Canada, for example. Never mind that their outcomes are slightly better than ours. In 1948, when the newly formed United Nations decided to enunciate a global consensus on basic human rights, their Universal Declaration of Human Rights included the assurance that everyone has the right to a standard of living adequate for the health and well-being of himself and his family, including food, clothing, housing, and medical care. The U.S. signed most of the international pronouncements, but never implemented a universal right to health care within its own boundaries. We have never, ever taken that action, even in intention, which I thought was very telling. So what do you think? Are we cold, callous, and obsessed with our own lives and bank accounts? Do we think everybody has the right to medical care when they get sick? In polls that have been done of Americans, 85% of us answer that health care is a basic human right, and yet as a nation, we don't provide it. So this Reed believes that part of the reason is most of us don't really know this is happening, and that's why I sort of belabored the point by giving you some of the facts about how this works, is that he believes most Americans think that everybody is covered. And then he quotes George Bush. He said that during his presidency, Bush repeatedly assured the American people they need not worry about their uninsured neighbors. And this is what he said, quote, "I mean, people have access to health care in America," he told a business meeting in Cleveland in July of 2007. "After all, you go to the emergency room." So, okay. So a little bit on Robert Reich, and then I want to go to the basic assumption questions. His idea is that in the Cold War, we developed a lot of technologies that as the Cold War dimmed, and we had this capacity, we needed to figure out what to do with it. So his idea was that what we did was we converted these amazing technologies that have been invented in communications, in surgeries, in radiation, etc., in tools for surgeries, that we converted it to medical care and began to have this highly technologically advanced care available. And of course, we still tout that we have the most technologically advanced care in this country, although it's, I think, less arguable now. And so companies began to see that they could start applying for-profit, more for-profit strategies to healthcare systems because they could market this to consumers who wanted to make sure they live forever, which is another aspect of me-ness in this country from my point of view, is that we're a very death-denying culture. We'd like to pretend that somehow, some way, we're all going to keep living, and we'll do almost anything to try to make sure that happens. You all know the statistics about how much healthcare resources are spent in the last 3 weeks of life or thereabouts. Let's see, I'm not going to go over all this. I would like to just talk about one movement, though. He talks about the Milton Friedman, the economist who became very popular in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. And I can't remember if he was in Reagan's administrative cadre or not. But what Reich talks about is that we got in love with the consumer possibilities of taking advantage of all the technologies that were available to us as consumers, not just healthcare was influenced by the burgeoning technology, but we started to get liquid crystal televisions, we started to get wireless communications and devices, and that from Reich's point of view, capitalism and the free market became our way of being, beginning in the late 70s and 1980s and continuing to the present. And this is where he begins to make the hypothesis that we got more affection for being consumers and investors. And he points out that some vast number of us are investors, not by our own volition, but because our retirement money is invested for us by companies that invest in the stock market. And he said at one point in the 90s, when he had done some research, the average American family had $5,000 invested in the stock market. And we started reading stock, daily stock reports in huge volume at that point. So it's sort of interesting to see who was paying attention to the stock market and who wasn't. Many, many more when the funds started to be invested. But let me, here's this quote from Friedman that I adore because it's so telling. Few trends could so thoroughly undermine the very foundation of our free society as the acceptance by corporate officials of a social responsibility other than to make as much money for their shareholders as possible. That's from Capitalism and Freedom. He published in 1967. So I think I'll stop there and talk about basic assumption life. There's a lot more to understand about these arrangements, but we have, another half an hour. And I'd rather stop. There's more to say about all this, but you can probably guess it or you know it. And I'd just like to say that Reich's hypothesis that capitalism has trumped democracy, and the way he analyzes that is that we become consumers and investors and let our roles as citizens of a democracy fade. And so I'd like to just talk about that a bit, because I believe that capitalism, that being an investor and a consumer has a very materialistic appeal. But the reason I'm curious about this is when I ask you the question about whose flesh in the room was more valuable, that's a material question too. That's a question about materialism. But our bodies are the material in which we reside, at least on the planet, so far as I know. And so the question is, why have we become more interested in material that isn't us, and that it's other things? And what basic assumption life might that be tapping into? Because I'll tell you, I just for me, in the last maybe 5 years, I can barely tolerate walking into a mall. I don't do malls anymore. I haven't bought any new clothes in 5 years, literally. It just is intolerable to me to have my role as a consumer call forward. It's just, I mean, groceries I'll buy and utilities I'll pay for. But we drive old cars, and it isn't because I don't admire new cars. But there's something for me, and you, I'd love it if you all would speak to this question about consumers and investors versus citizens, that is barely tolerable to me anymore. It's really begun to be very distressing to me. And I think the basic assumption life that's kept, until this recession, that's kept us locked into our roles as consumers and investors without taking action on something as serious as the healthcare situation in this country, we need to understand it. I'm not sure what can be done about it.
I have a question, which, as you were talking and thinking and some of the other conversations we had around this, can you talk a little bit about the difference in your mind between...
Can we all hear your question?
The difference in, between the basic assumption of meanness and narcissism.
Well, you know I'm not a clinician, right?
Yeah, so right.
I have a layperson's idea about what narcissism is. Did you want to answer this one, Lynn?
No, but I think I too, like you, Charlotte, sometimes struggle with that, having been an educational consultant and having a lot of background in psychology. It's hard for me to sometimes flip the vocabulary. Mm-hmm. So even when you didn't want to go over basic assumptions, mm-hmm. yes, I've read all that. Yes, I looked at the primer. But like when you start talking, when Mark starts it, it's like, oh my gosh, I have to... change channels or shift mm-hmm. gears. Mm-hmm. And yet I think it's important for this organization to do that mm-hmm. because that's what makes our connection all the more viable. But I struggle with it.
To try to respond to you, I think that, narcissists could be the members of a meanest group. Mm-hmm. If that makes any sense. I mean, I'm not just kidding. I also think, the question is, what part of us reaches out to another? I mean, do any of you know people who don't have access to health care?
Yeah.
Yeah. And have you seen anything happen to them, like illnesses get worse?
Yes.
Or?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, I think we all have some experiences. I have a lot of them because sometimes I was looking at the charitable care budget of some of the systems that I worked in and noticing that administrators were trying to squeeze it down. But, of course, then I knew they were going to hospitals across the river. Do you know what I mean? It was really awful at times. So
there was a book written 10 years ago, 15 years ago, some of you may remember, called The Culture of Narcissism.
Yes.
Right? It was longer ago than that. Oh, God, don't tell me that, Bernie. How long ago was that?
It's 70.
Almost 40 years ago.
Oh, God.
40.
Forget it.
You were young.
Yeah. What 40
years?
What point are we going to make?
Well, the idea of the culture, the basic assumption of the culture.
Yeah.
And around that. And, so that the development of this. You talked about the, Gould and Lawrence coming up with the idea of meanness.
1995, yeah.
95, but if Lash was around before that, then certainly the development of this way of our approaching mm-hmm. our response to the community mm-hmm. May have been developing longer than that.
Yeah. Yeah,
well, there's a new research, maybe a few years old, by a researcher at the California State University in San Diego, Twain, I think is her name is, on narcissism, and shows that it has increased since 2000, quite a lot.
In the 10 years?
Yeah.
Wow.
And it's the new generation, mm-hmm. and she mentioned things like... children always get positive feedback. They always are winners. Lots of stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And a second book, that's what she, I think her name is Eichenhardt or something, a woman that she got breast cancer.
Oh.
And she went through a process. Mm-hmm. where everybody told her to think positive mm-hmm. about it. Mm-hmm. And if you don't think positive, you are bad or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So she wrote a book about, the title of the book was How Positivism Undermines America.
Mm-hmm.
And so maybe these two goes hand in hand. Mm-hmm. And very interesting, quite important philosopher today, Slavoj Žižek, is a Slovenian,
mm-hmm.
talks about how in clinical therapy it has shifted that the guilt today mm-hmm. in the patient is for not enjoying. While the guilt the patient earlier was not to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm.
So earlier one mm-hmm. had to work with a patient could enjoy life mm-hmm. and don't not feel guilty about that. Mm-hmm. Today is opposite.
That's fascinating. Hmm. Yeah, Gordon.
Well, Charlotte, in listening to your presentation and thinking about Alfred's presentation mm-hmm. the keynote yesterday.
Right.
And you're posing the question, so why is it there isn't an upsurge of effective and you didn't say it, but whistleblowing in effect. And because what we're talking about is something that is going on virtually by policy.
Yes.
It is not
mm-hmm. yes.
covert. It is not hidden.
Right.
It is not even
mm-hmm.
illegal.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But I wonder if there isn't something about the sense of the sense of something that could be either lost. I mean, you hinted about all of the middle class people who, you know, may lose jobs if there's meaningful reform.
Right.
If there's something that connects with either knowledge that is either not disastrous, but that there's something like that. So that maybe it is a basic assumption, or maybe it is some other quite powerful social dynamic.
Well, I don't know if we could separate the two. I mean, I guess my immediate response, and Bob, I want you to say, but is that this is all by our consent. We have all lived and enjoyed, in large part, the era of neo-capitalism. We have all enjoyed it.
Yeah, I think there's a
thought. And I think, you know, this is just an artifact of that.
Well, yeah, and I guess the other thing that it's just an association, but the striking thing about the last, well, certainly every war I can think of back at least through Vietnam, is the spectacular unwillingness of the government to ask citizens to sacrifice.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it seems to me that there's something in that that is at least mirrored or resonating in this.
I agree.
Although I don't know quite what more to do with it.
Well, just to attach to that, some of the people that I read said, you know, this is not so bad because if we didn't have health care to do this for us, employ so many people, and generate so much profit, we would go to bigger wars.
Right. Well, actually,
which I found to be a very interesting idea.
It's not that nobody's had to sacrifice, but there have been pockets of people who have, just as there are certainly 60 million people who are uninsured and others who may have insurance and who effectively won't go to the doctor because
right.
they really can't afford
right.
it.
Right, right.
There's an economics attached to that sacrifice. The Vietnam War was called the poor man's war because the people who were asked to make that sacrifice were people who were not in school. And so it separated people who could afford to go to school yeah. from people who could not afford to go to college. Mm-hmm. And so what it did was it was an economic split.
Right, but I remember the whole business about guns and butter and the idea that nobody was going to, and the broader population not going to war, mm-hmm. was asked to give up anything.
No, they weren't. And so therefore the Vietnam vets came back and there was no celebration. Mm-hmm. No one greeted them. Because, in effect, their sacrifice was attached to their poor economic condition, and these were not citizens,
yeah.
worthy citizens.
Of course, that's largely true about health care. Bob was next, and then we'll come over here. But that's largely true of the health care crisis today. Obviously, people with fewer means and people of color are of much higher percentage of the 22,000 people who die every year because they can't access care.
By the way, just to put that into perspective, 33,000 people a year commit suicide in this country, and homicides account for only 18,000.
Hmm. Interesting. You were going to comment.
Well, what I was going to say is really very simple and naive. I don't know if it's increase of narcissism, if it's the basic assumption of meanness or whatever it is, but I think one reason that nothing changes or changes very slowly, if it changes, isn't all these complex ideas so much as I'm all right, I have insurance,
right.
and I think that it's because the majority does, mm-hmm. and there's very little ability to identify with the people that don't. And so the motivation, particularly among the policymakers and most of their constituents, is, well, I'm okay, so why is this a deal?
Right. Right.
Except,
of course, you know, that I agree to an extent. The question is, look at the uproar that occurred and is still occurring around the passage of the Health Care
Act. Absolutely. I think a lot of
which reflects something else that's going on, which you touched on. Mm-hmm. And the question I had when you talked about the data that show people think there's
there's a
right and there is a system. Mm-hmm. But the other thing you mentioned is about the for-profit nature of healthcare, and that whether there was any data about whether people believed
that healthcare, provision of healthcare, should be for profit, because that gets to
most of us don't. But it's clearly a prevailing economic model. So most of us don't think that we should commodify healthcare, because it's because people are sick that they need healthcare. So deep in the American heart, there is this conviction that healthcare should not be made the subject of anyone else's benefit. However, you know, the culture around us seduces us into participating in the very broad business of capitalism. I mean, it's just so compelling. I mean, think about it.
Well, and see, I think many people have no sense of that either.
Right.
Because so much of the stock, for example, in these large insurance companies is not held by me as an individual or you as an individual.
Right.
By these large pension funds and so on, and I have awareness of that.
That's right. And, you know, partly I wanted to do this because I wanted to figure out if I thought basic assumption life could have such broad application. But also, you know, in my own journey to try to understand what is such an unconscionable circumstance in our society, it's about that I want other people to be aware of it, too. And I don't know how many people are, but honestly and truly, this just confounds me, you know, even after my years in working with Judy and then Frank and then...
Yeah, I'm going to take up the consumption issue tomorrow in relation to the environment. So I want to be really clear. Are you opposing consumption with health? Healthcare somehow?
I'm opposing what I'm trying to oppose is that we still have somewhere in the American psyche a sense of responsibility for our cohorts, the others in our milieu in our country, but that gets swamped by the appeal of owning more, being more, having more, and especially in our roles as consumers, as people who get a hold of goods and have overcrowded homes and the newest flat screen TV. And my husband told me last week we're going to have to get rid of our LED and get an HD or something, and I'm thinking it took him 3.5 years to even convince me to get a flat screen, so this sell is going to be a lot harder. But that we become creatures of our roles, the impulse to care for, because it won't cost any of us any more money. Let me just say that. It's clear that it won't cost any of us any more money than we're spending now to insure everybody if we get a single party payer system, which won't have all the costs involved that we've already talked about. Now, who will lose? Shareholders, middle class people like me with jobs, you know, I mean, there'll be a lot of losers in this, but the question is it the capitalistic system that we're going to try to serve? Are we going to continue to be seduced by being consumers and investors? Are we going to try to strengthen citizenship in ourselves? Can we bring that question to consciousness? Maybe we're not. My pal here isn't sure we ever really had a commitment to it.
Well, I do, but let's have Frank.
Let's keep going.
I find myself focusing for the moment on the vested interests that sort of, to me, account for a major component of this phenomenon we're looking at, where consumerism has replaced citizenship.
Well, it's certainly, yeah.
Where, you know, our current most... you know, visible erstwhile populist movement, the Tea Party, is financed, driven, literally financed by a small cadre of extremely rich individuals who are sort of like prodding these people and getting them out there, and they confuse the debate. So each of the last two Augusts, if you go back to August in 2009, you have people screaming at these town hall meetings who have no idea what they're screaming about.
Go ahead. Well, what I was going to say is I'm joining you because, you know, my take on the Tea Party is it's fake. What it is it apparently looks like the reemergence of citizenship. Mm-hmm. That is total bullshit. Do you know, but it looks like, sorry. Well, you guys know me. Now you've heard it out of my mouth too. But I really think it looks like it's a false front. Do you know, Tea Party, you think about all the connotations it pulls for, but that's not what it's really about, right? It looks like citizenship.
And they look
it's
like,
a lobbyist group.
Yeah.
Those businesses have collectively.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. They're like, they're sort of like the real life, like a manifestation of like negative K, right? They get out there, and anybody who might be able to think about the problem and put the pieces together can't.
Exactly right. Exactly. That's what I think their function is. Yeah.
I think one thing, and this may be stating the obvious, but and I don't know what basic assumption this fits into, but I will confess to just enough of this myself that you know, maybe in other people's minds too, and it certainly was very evident. We were kind of traveling around the West the summer on vacation. We would stop in little towns and go in antique stores or in restaurants or campgrounds or things. There were some amazing conversations that I heard. People talking about death panels.
Yeah.
I remember one call, I had to leave the store. Somebody was talking to somebody else in the store. My mother died last year of Alzheimer's. I'm so glad, this is terrible to say, but I'm so glad she passed before the death panels got established.
My God. No,
okay. So, and you know, when I hear that, I think it's like total nonsense. I understand, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. what fact it was started that distortion. Mm-hmm. But death panels?
Well,
and then that was this year?
Huh? That was this year?
Last summer? This past summer?
Yeah, that was this past summer.
Because I thought death panels went away a year ago.
No.
Oh, they're still out there.
People are still talking about them in West Texas.
Yeah.
You know, I think another thing that's driving all this stuff is probably a very primitive fear, you know. Mm-hmm. What happened to me if I was in there and would they really check and would I get, I mean, I have lots of insurance. Would they, panel's going to decide?
Or? Yeah.
Let me raise this question, because I agree that, you know, that a lot of the uproar is propaganda driven in the truest sense of the word, and you know, with these kinds of hidden persuaders, you know, hidden manipulators around.
But it's real,
and what is it tapping into? Which I think gets to your question.
It's easy to sell.
You know, why is it so easy to sell? Why does it have such cachet? Why does it find a receptive, hearer that you see this? You know, I don't think it's all. I think you have to make that kind
where it gets severely serious for me, as Wesley Carr would say if he were here. In times in my career when I've been flying a lot, because I used to have a private pilot's license. My father was a pilot. I know the probabilities of when you go down and what kind of plane and all of that. And I played in my awareness about, would I let a child be saved instead of me? You know, this is since I passed the age of 50 or something like that. And I thought about it. I thought, so if this plane goes down and there's only a number of us that can get out, or there's a fire and I have to push somebody out and I'm not going to, what would I do? Do you know, I play with this question because I think it is a social question. It is a responsibility question. You know, it has a lot to do with philosophy, really. So my question is, what is it that makes the way of living we've arranged for ourselves in the last four decades more seductive than the ongoing march of the species in some sense, which is deeply connected to healthcare? Right? I mean, this is what's just fascinating me. So we only have a couple more minutes. Jennifer, and then Wilton, and then Sydney, and then Ole, and then Sydney. Please. But we don't have much time.
I just wanted to shed light to a different perspective, and going back to the idea of consumerism and meanness. So there is also this countercurrent called social entrepreneurship.
Yes.
And that there are these companies out there, for example, the CEO of Tom's Shoes, who every single time that they sell a pair of shoes, they give a pair of shoes to children in a third world country. And so again, and these companies are very profitable, and also it's very evident with the rise of the organics movement. So I feel that there is a way that we can get what we want, but also having the collective in mind about how are our practices sustainable and how are we going to make this place.
No, I agree, but let me ask you this question. Is that a for-profit company?
It is.
Okay. Yes. See, I work in this grocery chain, right, that composts more food than more food products than any other company in the whole Portland metro area. But what I learned there, in spite of all of its goodness, is that it's fundamentally about the financial engine. So I've gotten really cynical. I mean, it's not that good works can't go along with capitalism, but I've begun to sort of like think again myself. So I agree with you, and I'm still not sure. So then Wilton and then Ole, but we've got to move quickly, and then Sydney.
I'm responding to the last 10 minutes of your presentation, and I guess most of it, and responding to the discussion. I think that there is a gap there in our understanding of what postmodern culture is all about. Mm-hmm. I think that culture is in a transition between modernity and postmodernity. Mm-hmm. And the elements of postmodernity have to do with globalization, the way the economy works, with the way citizens have become consumers, and the way subjectivities are being constructed. And they're being constructed in different ways that have different pathologies. Narcissism is one of them. Schizoid personality disorder is another one. Mm-hmm. Psychopathic tendencies, mm-hmm. meanness is another one. There is a whole range of, you know, those kind of pathologies that have been studied. And I think that in Naked Rise, I think there is something missing in that respect. I think that the article that Bernie wrote on postmodernism and postmodernism, mm-hmm. group relations is crucial in that, in that mm-hmm. respect, because at the end of your presentation, you were questioning how can basic assumptions help us understand phenomena, what's going on with healthcare reform, mm-hmm. how the public is responding to that, how that is being constructed by the media. And I think that, you know, maybe in postmodern culture, there's new basic assumptions that need to be mm-hmm. explored and analyzed and, you know, brought up to the surface maybe. Of our understanding.
I may just be a little retarded in figuring out that meanness is real.
That takes us to switch from the modern insensibility that's at mm-hmm. the basis of the Eighth Horizon group relations movement. Mm-hmm. And you start thinking in terms mm-hmm. of this switch in the postmodern mm-hmm. sensibility and thinking.
Yeah.
There's a whole body of literature out there.
That's true. It's true. I thought about it. If I had time, I was going to read more in there.
Yeah, I find it there, but it's extremely interesting. First of all, I want to really quickly say four or five things.
What? 10 seconds each.
I'll be a little bit provocative. First of all, the Tea Party and those distractions there is not the main problem.
Oh, no.
Yeah. Oh,
it's just an expression.
Look at the middle class. What's happened to the middle class? There's no left side left.
Well. It's tiny.
And what Jennifer mentioned is a part of the problem. Capitalism integrates everything mm-hmm. that has previously mm-hmm. been unique and mm-hmm. against capitalism. Yeah. So capitalism incorporates the hippie generation to become a part of the capitalism. Yeah. It eats up everything.
Yeah.
Then I think what is going on in the middle class, and on especially on the left side, which is what's going there, is really crucial here. And then we have this concept of fetishes disavowal.
Disavowal.
Which is opposite of repression. And it mm-hmm. functions more mm-hmm. like this, that we know very well what's going on. Mm-hmm. But I still don't believe it.
Well, see, that's why...
Because we cling to our fetish object. Yeah. And the fetish object is many here. One of those are these pair of shoes that are sent down there. Yeah. Or it's these ideologies that mm-hmm. we don't think are ideologies mm-hmm. today. Mm-hmm. And another interesting thing, and then I'm going to stop, is also go back to Karl Marx mm-hmm. and call mm-hmm. the commodity fetishization chapter in Capitalism.
Marx looks more relevant all the time.
Sydney, yes, Sydney, and then we're going to have to...
And then I have something very brief to read you, but...
I'm still stuck back at your image of the mall, because mm-hmm. it's such a toxic mm-hmm. image mm-hmm. to me. Mm-hmm. In contrast to, you know, what other people call the commons, which in my mind is public parks and public monuments and shared space. In a mall, it's fake air. Every visual element we encounter is meant to sell us something.
And that's where kids hang out now, is in the malls. And so one idea, I've just been holding those for a little while, one idea I have is that's a defense against natural processes and maybe a defense against death.
We're all in the Truman Show.
I agree. I'm with you on it. I just wanted to read this quote. Some of you have probably read or at least looked through David White's book called The Heart Aroused. It's an exploration of how corporate America is squeezing out the sense of humanity that he advocates we carry. And, of course, he quotes a lot of literature, which makes him very endeared to me. But this I'd like to read you because when I was doing the work on trying to understand this, this came back to me and I looked it up. Modern business life arises from a love of the upper world, of material products, of order and organization. It celebrates the material, light-filled portion of existence. It is the world as we see it, or as we would like to see it, and that makes the most sense to us. It has been the basis of our Western affluence, and by the life it has provided many of us in the West, it has so much to recommend it. However, and then he talks about this book, it's written for those who've chosen to live out their lives as people in postmodern corporate American countries and who struggle to, companies and who struggle to keep their humanity. The book stands or fails on its ability to do what Wordsworth called a dark, invisible workmanship that reconciles discordant elements and makes them move in one society. Not because what is dark and invisible is necessarily better, but because it is not joined to what is light and visible to us in the everyday corporate world, it has been pushed away and ignored. And for me, that's this question about healthcare. It's on the surface. Those of us who've worked in it, who thought we were doing good work, those of us who have been the partakers of its care, and all of that looks fine. But unless we look at the dark underbelly of what we've consented to, we're missing something.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you for coming.
Thank you.
Thank you.